Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matte. Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us for another episode of Useful Idiots. We missed Monday morning this week, but we are back full steam ahead, bringing you the latest in this very, very grim world of ours with the election fast approaching. That's exciting. Kamala Harris against Donald J. Trump. What a choice we have. We'll cover some of that a bit on today's show and bring you a very interesting interview.
Yeah, we have a great interview with Chaim Brashith Zabner, who is a historian, an academic, a filmmaker, and also the author of a great book called An Army Like No Other, How the Israel Defense Forces Made a Nation. He has really interesting insights as someone who grew up in Israel.
And to support the show and get bonus content, including this week's extended interview, go to our website, usefulidiotspodcast.com.
So let's start off with the four basic food groups. Let's take a look at the very brave and tireless Prem Thakur. I'm actually surprised he's still let into these press conferences from the State Department. Here he is asking Matt Miller about how many more patients have to be burned alive by U.S. bombs until the U.S. says enough. And of course, that's in reference to Israel's bombing of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital tents, where people were literally burned alive. So let's hear what Prem had to say, and then what Matthew Miller had to say.
Prem. Thank you, Matt. One of the people the world saw burned alive by the bombing at the Gaza Hospital was Shaban Al-Dalou, a 19-year-old engineering student who was still attached to an IV drip recovering from a previous bombing. And his story kind of speaks to how this isn't just about one attack. A 19-year-old having to provide for his family, repeatedly displaced, brought to hunger, bombed twice in a matter of days. This is a year, and this isn't out of nowhere. So how many more patients burned alive by U.S.
We don't want to see any. We don't want to see any.
Well, I guess the U.S. has said, you know, again and again, that no civilian loss is acceptable 10,000 deaths ago, 20,000 deaths ago, and yet it's continued. So how does this answer mean anything without a policy shift?
It is an incredible.
The craziest part of that question is 10,000 deaths ago, 20,000 deaths ago, the actual official death toll is an undercount. You know, the official toll is still around 41,000, but there's no way it's that low. So even this massive amount of civilian casualties that is the official number, even that is too low. It's so many more deaths than we even know, because we just can't possibly count all the dead bodies in Gaza.
Incredibly difficult environment that Israel operates in. And I'll just make clear, the thing that question leaves out, as often happens, and I understand why, is the burden that Hamas bears. And not just the burden that Hamas bears by hiding behind humans and using humans as civilian shield, but the burden that Hamas bears in not coming back to the table to try to get to a ceasefire. So Israel needs to do more to minimize civilian harm. Hamas needs to stop hiding behind human shields. Both of those things can be true. Both of those things are true. And ultimately, the horrific human toll over the past year is why we continue to push to get to a ceasefire, and why we want to see both sides agree to a ceasefire.
Okay, so a couple things to unpack here. One is that the human shields argument, they love to pull this out as if it justified what Israel is doing. Like, I'm sorry, but you don't get to literally incinerate people in tents because of the use of human shields. That's one. But the other thing is that there's no documented use by Hamas of human shields, according to Amnesty International. But you know who we do know uses human shields? Israel. So if Matthew Miller wants to be consistent, he'd also be calling out Israel for using human shields. But they're just so used to it as a talking point. It's really disgusting. Now, the other thing that is noteworthy is hearing him talk about Hamas not coming to the table. Miller literally said 2 weeks ago, quote, "We've never wanted to see a diplomatic resolution with Hamas." So which is it? Is there anything that Israel can ever do that the U.S. will criticize without reservation? Any war crime?
No. And the same excuse is trotted out every time by Israel that, like in this case, when they bombed the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, and by the way, not for the first time, this is like the seventh time they've attacked the hospital this year. They always say there was a Hamas command and control center there. So therefore, we can just bomb people sleeping in tents and burning them alive. With all these Hamas command and control centers, it's like Hamas is basically command and control in every single vicinity of Gaza, which therefore makes it a legitimate target. That's essentially the Israeli logic. And it just, what's incredible is we can still be doing this after 1 year. You know, it's 1 year of this, of bombing people who are trapped in a death camp. And the same excuses are being trotted out. How much longer can they have it go on for? Like, the recent step from the Biden administration is to send Israel a letter saying, you need to improve humanitarian aid going into Gaza in the next 30 days, or else we might cut your weapons. So basically, you know, allow more food aid in, or else we might cut the amount of weapons used to bomb the same people that you're making hungry. That's basically the Biden administration line. And by the way, their deadline of 30 days happens to take them past the election.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, who knows what will happen after the election comes, or whether they'll remember even this latest ultimatum, which of course they never follow through on.
It's so upsetting. I'm sure people, maybe not, but people have seen that image of the people being burned alive, and it's just so disgusting. And the young man who was 19 who was burned alive, there's also footage of him trying to fundraise to get out, to get to Egypt. And I mean, the world, to say the world has failed him is such an understatement.
All right. Well, turning to Republicans suck, let's remember that Republicans are doing their best to tell the world that they're even worse on Palestine, if that were possible, than the Biden administration, because they're constantly criticizing Joe Biden and the Democrats of not arming Israel enough, which seems impossible, but yet that's the case they try to make. So here is Senator Ted Cruz. He's running for Senate against a Democrat, Colin Allred, who is a hawkish Democrat trying to unseat Cruz. And here's Ted Cruz making his case for why he should be in the Senate, and that's because he stands with Israel.
Congressman Allred is proud to be supported by J Street, the radical left organization that undermines Israel at every level.
And that's really funny right there. I mean, J Street, for those who don't know, is like a Israel lobby group that pretends to be critical of Israel, but supports pretty much everything it does. It supported the attack on Gaza. It's basically critical of settlement expansion in the occupied West Bank. But even there, its criticisms are meaningless. But Ted Cruz thinks that they're trying to undermine Israel. I mean, tell that to a Palestinian or anybody working in Washington trying to actually constrain Israel, and they will be the first to tell you that J Street is not their ally.
And I got to say, listen, that's dangerous. Right now, Kamala Harris and Colin Allred both want the votes of the anti-Semites on college campuses. I don't want their vote. And if they threaten Jewish students, they should be arrested. They Senator, should be prosecuted. They should be expelled.
Senator,
and if they're from another country, they should be deported.
Senator, that's your time. But let's stay right here. As you mentioned, you have been.
Ted Cruz going after the powerful kids on college campuses opposing genocide, and who somehow the Democrats want their votes when the Democrats have been demonizing them, supporting their expulsion, and basically accusing them also, like Republicans, of being foreign funded. So I don't know what he's talking about there. And of course, nobody will stick up for them in the political spectrum. They're just a punching bag.
A strong advocate of Israel's right to defend itself. But the world court has found it plausible that Israel has committed acts that violate the Genocide Convention. Do you think Israel bears any responsibility for the civilian deaths and humanitarian crisis in Gaza? You have 90.
By the way, I was really surprised to see that question asked. I wonder if that guy's going to get fired.
Yeah, well, you know, it's Texas. It's a state race. I guess like a local reporter has a lot more freedom than a national reporter, where the idea of mentioning the ICJ and Israel being plausibly accused of genocide, that's not really allowed on CNN or MSNBC, right, at least in a debate.
Yeah, you can't actually mention news.
I think there is no country on earth that fights a more humane, a more targeted, a more just war than the people of Israel. The World Court and the International Court of Justice is filled with anti-Semites. They repeatedly attack Israel over and over and over again. And I'll tell you, I've got real experience there. When I was the Solicitor General of Texas, I represented the state of Texas before the U.S. Supreme Court, fighting against the World Court. And we won a 6-3 victory because the World Court was trying to attack Texas just like it's trying to attack Israel. Listen, Israel.
So the World Court is not only coming after Israel, but it's coming after Texas as well. And Ted Cruz is standing in the way to defend both Texas and Israel. It's quite the daunting challenge there for him. But He seems very fired up about it.
A human shield. Talk about a human shield.
Anyways, that's Ted Cruz. He invokes the world court somehow attacking Texas. Everyone's an anti-Semite who wants to criticize Israel. That's the worldview of Ted Cruz. And that's pretty much the worldview of Republicans when it comes to Israel-Palestine. They have the same policies as Biden, but they just sound even more paranoid in supporting them.
Well, for isn't that weird, I have a story that, depending on your politics, could be an isn't that terrible, maybe could be an isn't that justice. But let's go to the always witty and clever New York Post, and let's read this sad story about a German neo-Nazi who plummeted to his death while hiking Hitler's favorite mountain. It couldn't have happened to a nicer Nazi. But what happened was he fell nearly 200 feet while hiking on what is believed to be Hitler's favorite mountain. Andreas Munzebauer, who was 37, was a senior member of the Bavaria faction of the neo-Nazi group The Third Way. And he was climbing Untersberg Mountain on a 30-person tour when he tripped on an exposed wet route and fell down rocky terrain to his death. So I guess you could say he died doing what either he loved or died doing what Hitler would have loved. But I guess it's quite a dramatic way to go. But what's interesting is that when I saw this news story on Instagram, and then I was, of course, directed to the New York Post, the comment on Instagram said, "White lives splatter."
Ouch. Well, one more reason, in case you needed one, not to do the Hitler hike.
Yeah. Avoid the Hitler hike.
Yeah. All right. First, isn't that terrible? Let's turn to Donald Trump. He just did what was billed as a women's issues town hall on Fox News with a pre-selected audience of Republican voters talking to him about women's issues. And one of them was IVF, which always leads to, you know, typically colorful Trump responses. So here are some of Trump's comments on the issue of IVF.
Or IVF. Right, let's get this question, yeah, because I believe that's what this is about.
Oh, I want to talk about IVF. I'm the father.
You don't
I'm
hear that every day.
I'm the father of IVF, so I want to hear this question.
Yeah. Hi, President.
So Trump is the self-proclaimed father of IVF. I'm not sure what he means by that. But as we can see in this next clip, he's actually not the father of IVF, or at least if he is the father of IVF, he doesn't know very much about it.
So although abortion does lie with the states, what is your stance on that? And what would you say to those women?
So I got a call from Katie Britt, a young, just a fantastically attractive person from Alabama. She's a senator. And she called me up like emergency.
All right. So first of all, he's talking about a senator and calls her a young, fantastically attractive person, showing that, you know, he really has not learned anything from like years of being caught making, you know, sexist, misogynist comments about, you know, the Access Hollywood tape. Right. He's still referring, we talk about women, to their appearance. And this is a senator he's talking about. But he explains more about their exchange.
But Aaron, I mean, to be fair, he calls her a person, which for him is probably not the word he would have used like behind closed doors, or maybe not the word he would have used before learning about how to be more respectful.
Ruled that the IVF clinics were illegal and they have to be closed down. A judge ruled. And she said, friends of mine came up to me and they were so angry. I didn't even know they were going, you know, it's fertilization. I didn't know they were even involved in. Nobody talks about that. They don't talk about it. But now that they can't do it, she said, I was attacked in a certain way. I was attacked. And I said, explain IVF very quickly. And within about 2 minutes, I understood it. I said, no, we're totally in favor of IVF.
Okay. So in the previous clip, he called himself the father of IVF. Now he says he needed a fantastically attractive young person, a senator, to explain it to him in 2 minutes. So for a guy who's the father of IVF, he's not very knowledgeable about it.
He's like a deadbeat dad, if you will.
There you go. He's the deadbeat dad of IVF.
Yeah.
So that's Trump.
All right. And that has been your four basic food groups. And we are so excited to bring on our guest. Professor Chaim Breshith Zabner is a filmmaker, photographer, and film studies scholar, and a professorial research associate at SOAS University of London. He is a founding member of Jewish Network for Palestine. His films include State of Danger, about the First Intifada, and he is the author of several books, including An Army Like No Other, How the IDF Made Israel. Chaim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you've written this excellent book, An Army Like No Other, How the Israel Defense Forces Made a Nation. But you're also someone who was raised in Israel, and of course you served in the army. So I want to know about your own experience in the army and how that has shaped your understanding of the army.
It might have had something to do with the way that I view other refugees like the Palestinians. Yeah. Now, basically, I didn't actually want to go to the army, and I think I didn't know at the time that my father was one of the first refuseniks in 1948 when we arrived to Israel. I was a baby of less than 2 years old, and he never told me about his episode of refusing until he was forced to sign up as a medic. So he sat for 6 weeks or so in jail until they broke him. Later on, he was afraid to speak about it because he was a bit ashamed that he didn't fight for the mother country and all that. But I didn't know that, and yet I didn't want to go into the army, but I didn't have the gumption to stand up and say, guys, I'm not joining. Before me, there was only one refusenik, Giora Neumann, he was stronger than me, obviously, because he went to jail, sat there for 3.5 years, but they never broke him. So I went into the army and tried to be very small so they won't see me, but that didn't work. And in the end, I ended up in the officer's training, and I became an intelligence and communications officer. Now, that was good for one reason alone. I wasn't in the battle. I was just outside of it. So in 1967, I didn't face, you know, the need to kill or be killed because I was in the headquarters, and that was, you know, like 400 meters away from, the killing. But not very far, but far enough for me not to be involved. Now, I don't know what I would do with all my goodwill and liberalism and opposition to violence if I was in a situation like I was saved of being in. So I'm not going to say I wouldn't kill, I wouldn't shoot, I wouldn't threaten, you know, because people have said this before and were proven wrong. But I'm very glad that I wasn't. And so I ended up not using violence myself, but on a number of occasions, I saw it being used on others. And that has made my opposition to the army even stronger. But in the battle in 1967, and I'm mentioning it in the book and the acknowledgements part, in the introduction, I was witness to a conversation on the radio at the headquarters when one of the commanders in the field, this was a battle in the Syrian Heights, very, very bloody battle. And he came on and asked for the commanding officer to tell him what to do because he has 200, meaning he has 200 prisoners of war, and he doesn't know what to do with it. Before anyone said anything, the commanding officer said, "No one speak." And he switched the mic off, and nobody knew what this means. And he said, "If he doesn't know what to do with them by now, I'm not going to tell him." And we all understood, what he meant. The commander, of course, did not want to kill people unless he was told, and he came on the radio again and said, I have 200. What do I need to do with them? Well, the mic was switched off. And so it went for the third and fourth time. Now, I understand that in the end, they were all killed, but no command was given on the radio. Now, we have been trained in the army to understand the IDF as a moral army that does not commit war crimes, that does not kill citizens, that does not kill children, doesn't kill women, you know, all this kind of nonsense, I believed in. I mean, I thought, I don't like the army, but at least it's a moral army. In other words, you know, all the stuff that we are now told on you know, American, British, and French channels, you know, Israel has the most moral army in the world. And you know, when Netanyahu comes to the UN and the US and he starts doing his spiel, that's what he always says. I had no idea of the depth of immorality that this army can plunge to, like it did in the last few decades, and especially in the last year. I don't think anyone, even people who knew the IDF very well and hated it very well, like me, did not work out this kind of sadism that we have seen in the last year. So my experience in the army never included fighting civilians. Yeah, it was purely, and that's not fun either, fighting other armies. Many of my friends were killed. You know, you learn to accept it when you live in Israel, because these things happen in war, and it will happen to us. And hopefully it won't happen to me. It'll happen to somebody else. But the idea that you throw a 2,000-pound bomb on, you know, a tower block with 1,000 people in it and kill, you know, half of them and the others are buried under the rubble, that was not something I could even think about, let alone foresee that it will happen. So these things are totally new to people my age, but not so new to those who were younger than me, because we've seen the destruction of Beirut twice. We've seen the destruction of Gaza untold times. And in each of those rounds of violence and death and destruction, soldiers and officers, supposedly, they are normal people. We know what Hannah Arendt had to say about this, but they acted as if they are not normal people. And in the last year, they acted if they are trained sadists, and they're getting a kick out of it in a way that I haven't seen other soldiers in other conflicts doing. And that is probably the worst thing that can happen to a professional army. But this is not a professional army. It's a democratic army. It's an army of the people. And the people are racist, hateful. They are Jewish supremacist, which on the whole means white supremacist. And the way that apartheid has trained them means that they have no compunction about killing any number of people, and any kind of non-combatant is fine. And when you look at those things that they share online, making fun of killing children and women, you know, using sexual memes, using undergarments to make fun of Palestinian women, you know, all this stuff. What can I say? If this is Judaism, I don't want any of it. And I don't think any of us can understand and recognize this as Judaism. So in a sense, what happened to Jews under Zionism is that they have basically forgot about their deity, whatever that was. You know, I never was a religious person. So the deity is neither here or there for me, but the deity meant morality in the traditional and historical Judaism that we all know about from reading on. But once Zionism comes, the deity is abandoned with its morality, with its social relations, and the army replaces that deity. The army becomes the god. If you remember, the word in the Bible in Hebrew about God is Elohim Tzvaot. Elohim Tzvaot means the God of the armies. It always translates as the God of the hosts, but it actually is the God of the armies in Hebrew. So, the God was replaced with the army, with the morality of a colonial settler society, which sees no value to the people that it needs to remove. So now it's what they waited for all those 76 years. This is a chance to remove all the Palestinians. Now also a chance to remove 2 million people in Lebanon and start settling Lebanon. This is now, they have now parties and companies that actually book you into Lebanese properties. They will do the same in northern Gaza, and then later on in southern Gaza when they get rid of the people there, and they plan to do it in the West Bank. So this is an experience I never could dream of in 1964 when I went to the army.
If you ask some of our haters, they tell you that Useful Idiots is a secret agent podcast funded by foreign governments. But you listen to Useful Idiots, you know we're American made. And at a time when it feels like most of our money is being sent overseas to fund weapons dealers, we want to show some support for a company that's doing their best to give good jobs to American workers and really good clothes too. It's American Giant, and since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic Full Zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. Check out the premium Slub Crew Tee, the no BS high-rise pant, and the slim roughneck pant featured in Giant Magazine. While most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. As you know far too well from listening to Useful Idiots, the 2024 election is coming fast. And while we can't predict for sure which candidate will win, we do know that either way, everyone else in the world will lose. Unless there was a fun and easy way to make a little extra cash on the whole terrible contest. That's right. Betting's not just for sports fans anymore. Now it's the political junkies' time to shine. We figure that if we spend all our time on Twitter anyway, following the election and endless political analysis, why not put our knowledge to the test? It's MyBookie, a new sports book that lets you bet on the 2024 election from the general election down to who will win each state. If the world is crashing anyway, why not cash in? Don't miss out on this. Pick a side. Use promo code USEFUL to double your first deposit and instantly start with a leg up. Only with MyBookie. What is your assessment of where Israel is, militarily speaking, at this moment? And are they going to succeed with their plans?
Well, as a historian, I cannot see the future, and I'm thinking about the past. But the past is actually a very useful way of speaking about Lebanon. We've had two major wars with Lebanon, 1982 and 2006. Israel lost both. What I mean is that in Lebanon, Israel had two wars in 2006 and before in 1982. 1982, politically, it won the war. Militarily, it lost it. In 2006, it lost both aspects of it. Now, why? Israel is a very modern country, depending, like the United States, on high technology, on all kind of the latest devices and the most powerful killing technology. In a sense, all aspects of the war, not just killing, but, you know, discovering the enemy, building an attack, and then, of course, killing, are done by technology. Guerrillas that Israel is fighting against, Israel is not fighting against any army at the moment. Even if it fought against Iran, it is not an army fighting an army in the normal sense. Probably will be limited to air force and missiles. So Israel is not having an army which can fight guerrillas. And, you know, people said this for decades, but they are not able to do that. They're not able to train an army that can fight guerrillas. The reasons are complex. Those guerrillas in Gaza, in the West Bank, the people of Hezbollah and other organizations are all fighting for their home. They're fighting to defend their right to live where they are, and they are indigenous, and they will not leave their homes, and they will fight over it until they're killed or they're winning. The Israelis are fighting for real estate. That's what they're fighting for. They're fighting for more land to settle, and more people to ethnically cleanse and genocide. So they are not fighting for their life. But actually, once they're thrown into a war situation with Hezbollah or with Hamas, they are fighting for their life as individuals, and they're not very good at it. The other thing is that two ways of using technology. Look, Hamas is very smart about using technology. Think about what they did on the 7th of October. Incredible use of very simple technology, you know, like motorcycles. The warriors who came flying in above the fence. So these are very simple technologies that the Israelis didn't even think about. They spent multi-billion-dollar sum on building the best and safest, you know, series of fences underground, above the ground, you know, all the electronics that went into it, all the automatic weapons that were shooting by computer and what have you. And what happened on the 7th? It didn't exist. It was even less effective than a Maginot line that was never used either. So this is the difference in the way technology is used. But, you know, Hamas have got very, very, you know, a small amount of some smart missiles, and they use them sparingly. But what they use is Second World War RPGs, for example, that they, you know, the RPG is costing about $100. Missile itself is like $20. Shoot that against a tank that costs something like 20 million, and they destroy the tank, and more importantly, they destroy four or five highly trained people in it. So the type of guerrilla war that Israel finds itself fighting everywhere, it doesn't matter how many times they did it before, they can't win it. In 2006, they moved 120,000 people into South Lebanon. Now, South Lebanon is mountainous. It's the roads are very narrow, and I think they were warned against it. So for 31 days, they did not use the army at all. They just used bombing you know, they said they bombed Hezbollah to smithereens, and they knew they didn't. So they had to move the army in, according to their way of thinking. They moved the army in, and within, you know, minutes, they had very many dead infantrymen. This also happened last week after the huge bombardment of Beirut and the rest of Lebanon, where, you know, already 2,500 people died, twice as many as in 2006 in, you know, the whole war. So they decided to move in. And when they moved in, they realized they can't move more than 500 meters. This is as much as they moved into South Lebanon, that they are already, you know, selling by lot to people that want to actually live there or say they want to live there. You know, this is incredible. They are unable to fight Hezbollah. They can actually kill, maim, and so on with, you know, like what they did with the electronic devices that Hezbollah used when they gave up the beepers and such like that they used because they realized that the telephones are giving them away to Israel. So they can do that. They can fight with that type of technology. But when it comes to fighting people in the field, they are unable to do it. And they never will be able to do it. They are too soft. They are Western soldiers. This is a battle of the West against the rest. And Israel is, in a sense, where it happens in the Middle East. Israel is the dog, the attack dog. But I want to say that in this case, it's sometimes very confusing. Who is the dog and who is the tail? It's clear that Biden is not in control. He's not in control of his own functions, and he's not in control of what is happening. But you can't say the same about Netanyahu. He's in control. Biden cannot or would not or doesn't control Netanyahu. Netanyahu controls Biden with not the slightest problem, as he controlled Trump before him. So this attack dog is the master in the Middle East. There's no doubt about that. And I want to say that many times people say, you know, don't forget, Chaim, the dog wags the tail. Well, here we are. The dog doesn't wag the tail. There's today one person in international politics that can start a world war. And it's not Biden. And Biden wouldn't know what to do if they said to him, do you want to start a war? He will ask Blinken what to do, or he'll ask Austin what to do. They don't know either. But they are actually playing a script that Netanyahu has written over the last 30 years. Even when he was working in the UN as Israel ambassador, he's already started the demolition job against Iran. He's never let off on that. That's his wet dream of destroying Iran. And he brought the whole West, but especially the US, into this wish fulfillment. And now he is about to get it. And the problem, the slight problem, is he is the most dangerous man in the world today. There are interestingly, they're both Jews, two people that can actually light a war into a nuclear war, and that is Zelensky and Netanyahu. For very different reasons, in very different backgrounds and so on. But this is very terrifying, a thought for me.
I'm so proud of our people. That we produce people with such power. What a thing to accomplish for Jews. Let me ask you about Hezbollah. The consensus in the U.S. was that Hezbollah was seriously decapitated because of the killings of so many members of their senior leadership, including Hassan Nasrallah. And then Hezbollah goes ahead and launches this drone attack on an Israeli military base near Haifa, kills 4 Israeli soldiers, wounds dozens more. This is a precision strike on a military site, unlike what Israel does when it just blows up civilian infrastructure. Do you think that Hezbollah's weakening has been overhyped? And do you think Hezbollah can deter Israel militarily without a ground war? I mean, you mentioned that Hezbollah can fight Israel on the ground and Israel doesn't want that. But in terms of Hezbollah's missile capacity to strike Israel, do you think that Hezbollah is still or can be a deterrent to Israeli aggression in the region? Because after a year, it hasn't stopped. Hezbollah has not stopped Israel's assault on Gaza.
Well, I don't know about being a deterrent to Israel projects in the region. I don't think anyone is trying to do that in the West. It's a bit like a Punch and Judy show when Biden, at very carefully calculated, points, says, you should not be evil. And Netanyahu said, yes, I will be. Yes, I will be. You know, I mean, this is nonsense. Yeah, this is just performative. We could even time it, those episodes of I'm asking you to kill people more kindly and let them eat before you kill them. And Netanyahu says, I never thought about that. Maybe I will do this, but I don't promise. So this is all set. The West is not trying to stop Netanyahu from destroying Iran or any other place or any other people. That's not what they're doing. They are actually arming and financing the destruction in all around Israel and protecting Israel while it's doing it. So Hezbollah, Iran, Hamas, the Houthis, and some groups in Iraq and in Syria are now trying to deter Israel from more bloodshed. They are more successful than Biden in doing that. So, we know that, this is all show. I mean, in the UK, they stopped the supply of 8% of the arms they sell to Israel, those that they don't, that the Israelis can do without, they just cut them off. I mean, this is just disgusting. Now, Hezbollah has already done a few things, which it will be useful to enumerate here. First of all, they got 80,000 people to leave the Galilee. And these people are now living in hotels in central Israel. They have no intention to go back. And most of the people in the kibbutzim around Gaza have also left, and most of them for good. So all those kibbutzim, apart from very, very few cases, there's one kibbutz that many people came back to. But remember, these were 22 points where they were attacked and sometimes destroyed. And to most of those places, Israelis did not return. So Hezbollah and Hamas have already created around 180,000 Israeli refugees. This is not a joke. Bearing in mind that these people can't work, that their children have to go to schools, that they have to live somewhere, and now they are ward of state because they cannot finance themselves. They're not home. So this is quite a weight for Israel. But because they don't work, a lot of the economy is now bust. The other part of the equation is that a lot of the men and quite a lot of women are now in reserve, so they don't work. In the north, nothing works because of Hezbollah. So Hezbollah is actually doing something of a great deterrent value by not allowing Israel to enjoy freedom while it genocides the Palestinians in Gaza. This is also the case of the Houthis and the other groups I mentioned. And in a sense, Iran you know, a lot of people in the States, in Britain, and of course in Israel, are talking about them as proxies of Iran. These are not proxies of Iran. They might be supported by Iran, but they're not proxies. You know, some of them are Shia, some of them are Sunni, of course. Hamas is a Sunni group. The other groups are Shia. Some of them are also Sunni in Iraq. So that's one thing. Secondly, all of those people come from the ground up. You know, Hezbollah is a Lebanese organization of the poorest people of Lebanon that were historically suppressed by the Christians who actually were allies of Israel. The same story of the Houthis. I don't need to say to you anything about Gaza. And of course, the relationship to Iran and the history of that relationship with Iran is very different in each case and has a different basis. So basically, the main thing is people of the Middle East in different countries, in different regions, with different resources, very different resources, are standing against Israeli oppression. And we call them, you know, terrorists, obviously. We call them, you know, Iranian proxies and the rest of it. Basically, they are part of a regional movement of resistance to the Israeli project of emptying the Middle East of Arab peoples. And this is not a project of Israel alone, of course. Israel is just a bit player in that. But an important bit player, it's a project of the American century. So it starts in the mid-70s, and there is all the evidence now of that project. And the spokespeople of those projects are 85% of them are American Jews and French Jews who are Zionists. Just look at the Islamophobic wave of that policy from the 70s on. And who leads it? You know, people like Bernard Lewis and Daniel Pipes and, you know, a whole load of them who are Zionists and who were actually, in a sense, put in there to write the agenda. Now, this sounds like, you know, I'm one of those conspiracy theories. But I'm not. I'm actually just looking at the historical evidence in much of the research that is in existence. So we now have very small and compared to Israel, weak forces that are actually doing the job of resisting the strongest army in the Middle East. That strongest army in the Middle East is a paper tiger. It can kill civilians. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, anybody can kill civilians if they have nuclear weapons and, you know, 2,000-pound bombs and so on. What's the big thing about killing civilians, yeah? But to actually fight armies or even to fight guerrillas, they're incapable of. So they need the Americans every 2 weeks to fly 1,000 flights of supplies in order to continue the killing. Without America, they would have been finished in mid-October 2023 because they will run out of ammunition. It is the West that is doing this genocide, and Israel is the tool. And you asked me about, can Hezbollah stop it? Or at least deter it. It is deterring it as much as it can. It is taking half of the Israeli army to the north. It is attacking only the soldiers, only the bases. It, you know, when we talk about these people as terrorists, now who is the terrorist in the Middle East? Is the terrorist the genocider that killed much more than the figures we get from Hamas? Because Hamas is also has a very strong motive to hide the real size of this. And if you look at the articles that were published about the number of people dying, then it ranges between 166 186,000 and 500,000. You know, let's just say that it's only 186,000. Not a lot of people, huh? Now, that's more than, you know, more civilians that were killed since the 80s. You know, this is in one small place called Gaza. Now, add the people in Lebanon, in Yemen, and other places that the Israelis are attacking, and just think a minute about what they plan for Iran, a country 10 times the size of Israel, which may well face Israeli H-bombs, because that's the plan. And I don't see a sign that the Americans are going to stop it. So Hezbollah cannot stop this on its own. Even the Iranians might not be able to stop it on their own, but they're not on their own. The Russians are now involved in Iran. They are arming Iran against Israeli attacks. They are advising. They have military personnel in Iran. Now, this is nothing to kind of sing and dance about, because what it means is that if the Americans and Israelis attack Iran the way they plan, that will be the doorway to a world war, which will be nuclear. I don't know if you read Annie Jacobson's book. If you haven't, please do. You know, Nuclear War, a Scenario. And the book is actually mapping the first and last 72 minutes of World War III. That's what it will take, and she's totally accurate about it. And at the end of it, there will be nothing. And this is what we see being prepared. So the fact that we are actually led by a group of war maniacs that are not taking into account who in his right mind as a leader would face the chance of wiping their own people, not to talk about other people, off the face of the earth. And yet, this is what the US and NATO have done since 2014. They've done everything to bring us to the brink. So I think Israel is part of that. We shouldn't think about this as ending in the Middle East. It is a long-term plan to weaken Russia and China. And Israel is playing its, you know, local part in this. So I don't think that anyone, let alone Hezbollah, can actually stand in the way of this unless BRIC came together and said, you know what? We will destroy you if you start this war. This is a deterrent. You want a deterrent? This is the deterrent. Now, I think the Russians more or less said this. And if you follow the press, Biden thinks that they are bluffing. Well, you know, that's not a joke. That is not a joke. And the same is true with China. They never were a militarized culture. China was a traditional trading nation for thousands of years, and their advance is a trading advance. You know, the Belt and Roads program is really, you know, it's an imperialistic program, but not of imperial conquest, but of trading. The American Empire is working through 1,003 military bases, true for last December and now probably larger, 1,003 military bases in the world. Now, all the other countries taken together don't have even 20 bases. This is what the picture of the American imperialism is in that number. That number tells you what kind of empire the United States is. So I don't think we should just think about Israel on its own, even for a moment.
What would these world wars look like? How would they break out? And obviously the West isn't doing anything to stop it, but if they wanted to, could they?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
And thank you again to Professor Chaim Breshith Zabner, who is the author of An Army Like No Other, How the IDF Made a Nation. And the takeaway for me from this interview is that the IDF has made a nation that is in trouble. And that is, of course, a threat to its neighbors, primarily Palestinians and Lebanese and all, also now Iran, but also just a threat to itself. And as long as it has, though, a blank check from the U.S., whether it's the Biden administration or likely the same policies under Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, we're in trouble. All of us are in trouble. I'm grateful, at least, that we can have some sensible discussions of it from people like Chaim. So very grateful to him for joining us and sharing his insight.
And make sure that if you're not already supporters of Useful Idiots, you go to usefulidiotspodcast.com because you're definitely going to want to hear the full interview with Chaim. Also want to make sure people go and check out bringgazahome.com. That's bringgazahome.com. And that's a very important project that he and others, he and Palestinians and other anti-Zionist Jews and anti-Zionist Israelis are working on.
That's been our show. Our website again is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there. Get bonus content and keep us going. Thanks so much for watching. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.